What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina. Now, Michael, we have a lot of heavy things to get through today. Obviously, there's a coronavirus spike going on in Florida, including around Orlando, where the NBA is still planning to have its return to play at Disney World here in a couple weeks. But before we get to that, I thought we should maybe take a walk on the lighter side because, you know, players are reporting to their home teams and their home markets this week. There's going to be a little bit, I think, of a headcount aspect to this. Who's going to show up? Who's not going to show up? What does everybody's roster look like? I think it's going to be a major talking point. We're seeing reports already over the last 24 hours that Davis Bertans for the Wizards will not be participating. There goes Washington's hope at a miracle run to the title. Also, other reports out there, Michael, that perhaps Anthony Tolliver is going to get picked up. So I thought what we should do is do an open floor version of who he play for. And I'm going to give you a time machine, Michael. We're going to travel back to February and March of this year, which honestly, I think after we do this exercise, you will agree with me, feels like going back in time about 25 years minimum. And I'm going to just, read off maybe some names of players and what happened to them, where they landed in February and March, and you give me your honest reaction. And we talk through maybe do those moves matter for this resumed season, in July. Because a lot of times in, the trade deadline season or the buyout season, some of those moves kind of get swept under the rug. They're not as big of a deal. But I'm now wondering, with some of this possible attrition, whether they're going to get a little bit more attention. How's that sound?
That sounds great. I mean, when you sent over some of these names, I completely forgot that they were on the teams that they're on. So this should be good for everybody.
I want to start with the Lakers just because, well, they're the Lakers and everybody always starts with the Lakers. But also because Avery Bradley and Dwight Howard have both kind of made some noise here over the last week about potentially not playing. Do you remember, Michael, the Lakers waived DeMarcus Cousins and signed Markieff Morris? Do you remember that happening? And do you have any favorite memories of Markieff Morris era in Los Angeles? I believe there was a Lakers blogger who tweeted out over the weekend that people forget Lakers Markieff Morris was a bucket, maybe like three or four buckets during his time there in LA. But do you have a favorite standout moment?
Yeah, he's a bucket about 25% of the time that the ball leaves his fingertips, which is what he shot in a Laker uniform. I do remember Markieff Morris getting signed. I'm going to be honest, I did not remember that DeMarcus Cousins was no longer on the team and that they had to waive him to sign Markieff Morris. So that's just a reflection of how much time has passed and everything that's gone on. And in doing a little bit of research for this, I just think it's wild that DeMarcus Cousins is still 29 years old and that he was the best center in the NBA, 4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. And he's just been a total afterthought for the past calendar year. And I know that injuries are a big part of that, but it is still really hard to reconcile with that fact, just how far this guy has fallen.
No, and how many millions that injury cost him. I mean, hundreds of millions probably over the course of, the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years as his career developed. It's pretty insane to think about. The Cousins one stands out to me because of the Dwight factor. You'll remember if we go all the way back to last summer, the Lakers were working out Dwight Howard and Joakim Noah, and they picked Howard, right? Noah winds up signing with the Clippers. Do you remember that in March on a 10-day contract? It sounds like they're going to keep Noah. Did the Lakers potentially get themselves boxed out here? If, depending on what Dwight decides to do, not really having Cousins because of the injury, not having Noah because he's on the Clippers, does that wind up being a factor here that we should look at in terms of that head-to-head matchup between probably the West top two teams?
No, I mean, signing Joakim Noah was a humongous addition for, it sounds really weird to say this, but it was a humongous addition for the Clippers just because they needed size. I don't know what exactly he'll be able to give them. But
that was hilarious. You got halfway through your answer and you started having flashbacks to Knicks Joakim Noah, didn't you? You started having some Madison Square Garden flashbacks and you couldn't stop yourself.
I saw him dunk, I remember, in a Memphis Grizzlies uniform. I don't even know what year that was, but it feels like 2019, maybe. And he looked okay. He looked like he was in shape and he could get off the ground. So shout out to Noah. I think the Lakers can technically, even if Dwight chooses not to play, I think they can re-sign DeMarcus Cousins if those two parties were interested in reuniting. I'm not 100% on that, but I mean, it's like going back, like this was something that I'm sure that they regret. I mean, DeMarcus Cousins, 100% healthy. He's now about a year removed from that torn ACL, about 11 months. So you would think he'd be able to potentially get into game shape at some point, hopefully before July 30th. And then more importantly, when the games actually start to matter in August and going on from there. But yeah, if Dwight doesn't come to play and you have Markieff Morris, who, you know, he's not a five. He's just, I don't really even think he's a positive impact player in any context, let alone on a championship contender. They're going to miss someone like DeMarcus Cousins and that type of talent. And obviously, yeah, there is a huge caveat with his physical condition, but I think DeMarcus Cousins on the open market now is still pretty intriguing, if not attractive.
Yeah, so I'm curious, if you were DeMarcus Cousins' agent, what would your advice be? Like, go down and play in Florida, or just chill and use the extra months for rest and recovery? Because for somebody like Kevin Durant or even Kyrie Irving, when you're an established superstar on a max level contract, you're kind of already comfortable. You really have no motivation to push it. Even a John Wall, same deal, right? No motivation to push it. The more time that it takes to get the next season started, the more recovery time you have, you've got no money on the table. For a player like Davis Bertans, where the payday is about to come, you have every reason to stay home, right? Because anything mm-hmm. that goes wrong down in Orlando just is money coming out of your pocket. So the agent's decision there is like, hey, man, even if there's some bad PR for you sitting out, which hopefully there won't be a ton of that. There won't be too many public guilt trippings, I don't think, considering these circumstances. And also the fact that, you know, Washington's going nowhere. I mean, if they were like a two seed, you know, it'd be a different decision, right?
Right.
But I think if you're Bertans, the decision to stay home is pretty easy. If you're Cousins, you're in the situation where, like, theoretically a contender could sign you, and that could boost your value. It's not like he's going to recapture the glory of the Golden State Warriors versus Toronto Raptors finals, where he had that one incredible game coming off the injury. I mean, that would be a lot to ask, right? But at the same time, I think he is an afterthought. The multiple injuries have scared some people. There is some motivation to kind of put your name back out there. But there's also a major downside here, Michael, because if he goes there, he's not fully ready and he gets injured, that could be it. People could view that as like three strikes and you're out. So if you were his agent, what's your advice? And I guess if you were Cousins, do you want to play or are you taking a more cautious approach? I know I'm asking you these impossible hypotheticals, but what do you think?
I think that if I were Cousins, I would kind of already consider myself at rock bottom. I see what you're saying with the downside. And if you play terribly or if you rupture another Achilles or something like that, then that's probably it. But right now, the upside to playing, I think, is pretty big. I mean, the whole world is going to be watching. It is a significant opportunity for him to re-up and reestablish his reputation as one of the better bigs in the league. And if he comes in and he's in shape and he looks great, as a free agent heading into next season, I'm not saying he's going to get a humongous long-term commitment from anybody, but he won't get the league minimum either, which I think is a positive for him. So, like, for example, if like the San Antonio Spurs wanted to sign him because of the LaMarcus Aldridge injury and slid him in there, and then the Spurs were able to surprise some people and maybe actually advance after the eight initial games because of Cousins' performance, then he just made himself a ton of money. That's a best case scenario. But if I was Cousins' agent, that would be a situation that I would not necessarily shy away from.
Very interesting. So I think it was Matt Barnes at some point here recently who made a comment like, you know, he won a ring with the Warriors, but did he really win it? You know, I think, I guess maybe he was just sort of like, well, you know, he wasn't a major part of that team down the stretch. And I'm curious, with some of these players, like a Joakim Noah for the Clippers or Reggie Jackson for the Clippers. Remember, he got picked up by LA. He didn't play too much there. I saw a couple of his games. I think I might have made a few sideways comments about his conditioning. So we'll see what he looks like if he shows up in Orlando. But with some of these guys, it's so funny to picture them winning like the first title of their careers after so many tough seasons, right? Or so many like playoff hardships. With a team that they have basically no connection with that like immediately got shut down during this COVID season. Like if the Clippers win the title and Reggie Jackson gets a ring, he'll have a ring before Russell Westbrook and James Harden, you know, his tormentors in Oklahoma City all those years ago. If Noah wins a ring, it's like, you know, compensation for all those, you know, brutal losses at the hands of LeBron James years ago as a member of the Bulls. And yet, is it really? Because it's the weirdest, like kind of craziest, you know, championship run here of all time. Just some layers to chew on, Michael. I mean, do you think these rings are going to count for these kinds of guys?
Well, I mean, the ring down in Florida, whoever wins it is going to be really weird. So it doesn't really matter. But I kind of just think this is like the NBA, right? We've been discussing the just constant churn of free agents and waiver wire guys and notable names for months now. So I just think like that's what the NBA is. That's what it looks like. So it wouldn't be too weird to me if Joakim Noah won a ring or Reggie Jackson won a ring. I mean, the Reggie Jackson situation is really interesting because Lou Williams is one of those players who recently said that he was currently 50-50 on whether or not he was going to go down to Walt Disney World and play. So if Lou Williams does not play, I mean, Reggie Jackson is a really good insurance policy, in my opinion. I was higher on that signing when it happened than I think just about anybody in this business. And you give him bigger minutes and an expanded role similar to what he had in Oklahoma City before he was traded to Detroit. And I just think that he can be a significant contributor in a positive way. I mean, they're not going to lean on him too much, but I think he could help off the bench.
No, you read my mind. I think that could wind up being a major move for them because you need that ball handling, that playmaking in the backcourt. You know, you need to carry potentially a second unit. You're used to having that guy. You're used to having the pick and roll combination with a Montrezl Harrell. If Williams doesn't play, that could be one of the biggest guys that we've heard of in terms of importance on the title chase to not participate if he goes through with that plan. So to me, the Jackson thing looks kind of brilliant in hindsight, if that's how it plays out. Of course, this is all supposing that Jackson's in shape and ready to rock and you know, performing at a little bit of a higher level you know, than we saw at times here in recent years. Michael, would it hurt you as a James Harden stan to see Reggie Jackson get his first ring before Harden? I'm not trying to rub this in your wounds, but how would you take that? Would it bother you? Because remember, there was all that friction, you know, back in those days, I guess in part because Jackson had to back up Westbrook. So maybe it was more of a Westbrook-related friction there. But, you know, let's say the Clippers knock the Rockets out in the second round of the playoffs and Reggie Jackson goes on to claim a title. Does he get up on that podium stage, socially distanced from Adam Silver, and dedicate the championship to his former Thunder teammates?
That would be one of the pettiest moves in NBA history.
Yeah, but who am I kidding? They're not even giving him the microphone, are they?
No, it'll be a wonder if he gets a hat. But if the Clippers beat the Rockets, I mean, I would just be personally devastated because I was wrong in my predictions and I don't like being wrong. So that would be my first mental check if that were to happen. But yeah, that would be pretty funny. I mean, you know, just like, I don't even know where you want to go from here. There's some other names that we should probably discuss. Some of these like really intriguing signings. I mean,
yeah, before we get
to those,
the Rockets did have a few, but now I'm picturing, what do the celebrations look like? Are they handing out masks instead of hats? Are they handing out rubber gloves for the champagne bath? Is there a way to properly celebrate this thing for CDC guidelines?
Dude,
we may find out.
I don't think that there will be a celebration. Like, I just, That's one of those things.
There's got to be a celebration. If you're stuck inside for 3 months, do you think the guys will just run out and break quarantine and just go crazy through the streets of Disney World? Is that possible?
Dude, how weird is it, though? Just, I think it'll be more like relief and just wanting to go home. Like, I'm so glad this is over. So if there was, I think, like, just like you can't celebrate. Like, what is there to celebrate, really? Like, the world has put professional sports and championships and all that into the proper perspective, I think, over the past few months. And I think that will continue on by the time they actually are deciding who wins this thing. I just think it's like, let's get this over with. I mean, people will be happy. Whoever wins will be happy and whatever. But like, I just can't see a typical photo op opportunity where, you know, there's LeBron jumping up and down. And it's just really unbecoming and strange to even consider.
So, Michael, in your view, the buzzer goes off. Nobody throws a basketball into the stands. They no. all go get their luxury Louis Vuitton travel bags and Gucci travel bags and immediately head for the tarmac with no presentation whatsoever.
That's what I'm rooting for, because I think that would be awesome.
If they can make it to the NBA Finals and crown a champion, there's going to be a celebration, okay? I think it might be a weird one. It might be corny, but there will be some level of celebration. Hopefully, they're not. I mean, the tricky part is all the hugging and the dancing. We don't want people going home, testing positive, similar to like what might happen at a frat, you know, foam party back in college. We don't want like an outbreak from the celebration.
No, but now that I'm thinking about it more, I think that the celebration will be like Adam Silver and Mark Cuban and Tillman Fertitta and all the other owners who have stuck around, and them just like dancing on the stage that they actually pulled this thing off and didn't lose $2 billion. Like, those are the people that are going to be celebrating more than the players, which is really gross to think about.
So in some, you know, luxury bathrooms at the Grand Destino, there's going to be a bunch of billionaires bathing like Scrooge McDuck in their gold bars is basically what you're predicting.
Yeah, remember that scene in The Last Dance where Michael Jordan's just playing the piano?
Yeah.
I can imagine Adam Silver at that same piano, just with a cigar hanging out of his mouth and a hat sideways cocked on his head with open champagne bottles. And yeah, that's the image that I'm thinking about if this actually gets pulled off with success.
And then the three NBA PR guys burst in the room and say, "Hey, Adam, what are we going to do about next year? It's time to start planning for 2020, 2021. All right, enough of that. Let's do a few more of these transactions. So obviously, we broke down in a lot of detail the Rockets' move to get Robert Covington and basically trade out Clint Capella, but they also made a couple other moves around the edges, getting Jeff Green and Damari Carroll, just kind of, you know, rejiggering their look, a little bit more versatility positionally in the front court. Do any of those moves seem like they could be helpful as we go into Orlando, or are they still kind of footnotes like they were back in March?
I actually think, like, I'm siding on them being footnotes, but I think the circumstance of playing down in Florida makes them more valuable for a couple reasons. Like, one, you don't know who's, you know, there's a possibility that someone can get sick on your team. So it's really dark to think about this and consider it, but having insurance policies with, you know, competent players who are, you know, could step in and play solid basketball and fit in this system, that's a plus to have. And then just considering, you know, I always go back to our quarantine draft and considering what matters down, or speculating about what matters down in Florida more than it would have in a normal environment. And I think someone like Jeff Green, someone like Damari Carroll, those are just vets. Those are pros. So I just think having guys who are professionals, who are veterans, who can step in and deal with the strangeness of everything that's happening down in Florida, I think that that's a plus, more so than it would have been if the season was just going on as normal. And Damari Carroll's probably not going to play any minutes. Jeff Green's probably going to play very limited minutes. But if they were to step in, they wouldn't be a humongous drop off.
Yeah, I hear that for sure. Another guy like that would be Marvin Williams with the Bucks, right? Like, I was pretty excited for that move for Milwaukee at the time. I mean, it's not the greatest thing in the world, but you feel like he's better than Ersan Ilyasova. He gives you a little bit more shooting. He should be a fit around Giannis. And again, it's just a basketball lifer who's played in a bunch of different situations over the course of his career, who, you know, just a natural fit, clean fit into an offense kind of in the modern era where he doesn't need to dominate the ball. He's not going to get in the way. He's going to have a good attitude. He won't be elbowing anybody, you know, to get a front seat at the DJ set on the lawn. You know, he's just going to be a friendly guy, you know, having a good time playing cards type of guy. So I think that, you know, that's a move where had this season been canceled or if they can't complete this thing for somehow, I would have felt really bad for Milwaukee because it was a case where like their process was good, their targeting was good, they were able to attract the right type of player, it was all a nice fit, it was lining up, and then for some, you know, reason completely out of their control, it didn't work out. To me, that's one where, you know, that could pay some dividends here going forward. The other big one we should probably mention is Miami's overhaul of getting guys like Iguodala and Crowder and not bringing along Justice Winslow. I know Winslow has made some comments about maybe not participating, you know, on behalf of the Memphis Grizzlies. For Miami, it was kind of a controversial, questionable move when they did it just because of the money being invested in Iguodala. You know, is this a team that's really going for some sort of a push? I mean, really, what's the point? Does salvaging Iguodala and getting something out of him this year make that move look better? Is it going to wind up not mattering? Is the extra time for Iguodala a good thing considering he's barely played over the last 12 months, or could that be a bad thing? How do you read the Miami's moves?
Yeah, I mean, I liked that move fine enough when it happened. I would have liked them to also trade for Danilo Gallinari. But I understand that you would have been sacrificing quite a bit of, including future cap space, to do something like that. But I, when I look at the Heat, I mean, what worries me is that Iguodala and Crowder only played 14 games in a Miami Heat jersey before the season ended. And so, like, that style of play down there is very specific and very particular. And it's going to take time to assimilate. And I highly doubt that they were comfortable or like 100% comfortable with everything that was going on before the season ended, and then trying to pick things up, it'll feel like the first day of school in a lot of ways for those two. I mean, Crowder did quietly shoot the ball pretty well, and you know, he almost made 40% of 7 threes per game, but he's also a free agent, so like, some of these, this kind of applies to other guys on this list, you know, with the Sixers, with Alec Burks and Glenn Robinson III, like guys who are playing for contracts, I just think are really, they're total wild cards in a lot of ways. And I don't know how.
Could be like a summer league situation where they just go up there to get their shots.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's another variable that I think it will be interesting to see how it unfolds. Because these guys just don't know. Some of it is not their fault. They don't really, you know, they're not assimilated. They're not 100% in tune with how their teams play and what their teammates want and don't want. And so I just think that part of it will be fascinating.
We need the Disney World camera footage after some guy like Alec Burks goes out there and takes like 18 shots in a playoff game and his teammates are just freaking out on him in the hotel like, bro, what were you doing? You don't even really play for us. You know your role. Not saying that's going to happen with him specifically, but it is a dynamic that you're mentioning we should you know, definitely keep an eye on. All right. One final who he play for, Michael. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who he play for?
You know, I know the answer, but I did not know the answer before I knew that we were going to be talking about this, which is kind of embarrassing, but I guess also don't blame me because a lot of stuff has happened.
You're proving the point of this exercise. This feels like so, so long ago. And I always feel like when we're doing this over the course of an off season, I mean, guys like us, we track it religiously, basically for a living, right? So those minor moves, you know, we always commit to memory in July, but then usually it comes around to September or October and you're like, oh yeah, that guy signed there. And as you mentioned, the pace of these transactions has just increased so much in the free agency over the last couple of years, you know, guys just switching teams constantly. It can be harder to keep up. Yeah, I think our listeners would be forgiven if they overlooked the fact that MKG went to Dallas. didn't do much in Dallas at all. He's kind of a weird fit there because they play so offensive-oriented. They always want to have the five threats on the court. He's not much of a threat offensively, but he is, you know, still got that reputation as an imposing, you know, perimeter defensive piece. If the Orlando games are really choppy and Dallas needs to, like, fit in and they can't get their three-point shooting going, is there some way for MKG to make a mark here in Orlando? Or am I still grasping at straws that I should have given up 6 or 7 years ago?
No, I think that what's interesting about him is, I mean, he's a five right now in the NBA, which is kind of wild to think about when you consider who he was when he was drafted and what the expectations were. But I personally think, like, on the defensive end, he can guard anybody, and that's obviously his strength. But on the offensive end, he's a five man, and that's basically a rim roller and someone who can impact the offensive glass and box out and just be all energy all the time. So particularly with Dwight Powell not around, who was hurt, who got hurt and won't play down in Florida, MKG might have some type of role that's interesting on offense with a really creative head coach. And obviously, Luka Doncic, one of the more ingenious passers we've seen come along in a very long time. So in a game where, like, you don't even need to tell Michael Kidd-Gilchrist to hustle, you don't really need to wind him up. He's always, like, gearing to go. I think he could be pretty intriguing. The jump shot is still the ugliest one in the league by a mile, but in bits and spurts, I think he can be helpful.
I really like that answer, Michael, because I felt like last week at times maybe the weight of our current reality was weighing on your shoulders. And to hear you break down for almost a full minute straight Michael Kidd-Gilchrist potential impacts on the Orlando NBA restart, I think officially marks the return of pro basketball, Michael. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing to listen to. Do you feel better?
I guess so, a little bit. It felt weird coming out of my mouth, I'm not going to lie, but yeah.
It's like you tried on your wedding suit for the first time in 8 years, and it still fits, Michael. It looks great, you know? So here's the deal. We got a bunch of awesome questions from the Open Floor Globe. They emailed us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. And Michael, I want to open with an email from our MVP listener. His name is Thaddeus. And people might say, why do you always include Thaddeus's questions? Well, here's why, Michael. Thaddeus will write us full essays almost once a week. And he's been doing this for, I don't know, a year, 2 years, 3 years. It's been a very long time. The level of loyalty from him is outstanding. He's always got great takes and great ideas. He decided to rant a little bit, Michael, on the state of Florida. I guess the state of coronavirus in the state of Florida. He writes, I'm loving the willingness to get into meaningful topics, guys, and it makes me proud to call myself a fan of the pod and not just Michael. So he likes you, the pod, Michael, and he also likes the podcast. Thaddeus Beautiful. Continues, I get that Disney is probably the ideal location, but Florida is a disaster currently being run by a disaster of a human being. Disney shamelessly values profit over everything else as a company, and the ESPN connection isn't subtle. I get that its state economy runs on tourism, but it's reaped the benefit of that for decades to the tune of no state taxes. It already feels kind of crappy that Florida and Disney get this economic boost that I assume is pretty sizable, and the idea that they would get an entire season played in Disney next year while the rest of the country is still a disaster would be pretty tough to stomach. So Thaddeus is going through it right now. I would say I believe he's feeling some type of way. Michael, we could put aside the question about next season for now. We were speculating on last week's podcast that they might have to be in a bubble again mm-hmm. for next year, which is with no travel and no ability to play in front of fans. But what do you make of the recent developments in Florida as pertains to the coronavirus? I believe they topped 4,000 new cases for the first time on Saturday. They had topped 3,000 cases for the first time, I believe, last Thursday. So this is clearly a spike statewide. It's mostly oriented in Miami-Dade County, but Orange County, where Walt Disney World is, is certainly seeing its own rise, its own uptick. The local government there mandated that people wear masks, I believe, starting on Saturday. Statewide, there has been no re-implementation of a mask policy. There has been no kind of rollback or slowdown of their phase two opening, which began earlier this month, which basically said, you know, bars and gyms and museums can operate at 50% capacity. But this thing has really taken off. I mean, Florida is becoming a hotspot, and the NBA is about to send 375 players and additional staffers, and there's going to be media potentially traveling down there to cover this thing as well. Is everybody going right into a nightmare scenario? And how concerned would you be if you were the NBA's decision makers? Over the weekend, they released a statement that basically said, look, well, it basically said nothing, but they said, we're monitoring we're monitoring the situation in Florida. We're in contact with the players' union, the local authorities, and you know, medical experts, and we'll continue to assess. I believe Michelle Roberts told ESPN.com that if they needed to make additional kind of reinforcements to the bubble procedures, that they would push for that, you know, if the situation got so bleak down there in Florida. But Michael, I mean, I know you've had concerns about this entire plan at every step of the way. Is this sort of not an I told you so moment, but are you feeling like, yeah, maybe we should be listening to some of these concerns? It's just another red light going off.
No, I mean, this just adds to how when, you know, our conversation about the protocol and the 130-page manual delivered by the league is like everything that they wrote looked great on paper. But in reality, that does not account for the fact that Florida is just a cesspool right now. And this state did not take coronavirus seriously as a threat months ago when they should have been. And what we're seeing right now is the result of that behavior. And like one of the really interesting stats that I came across in trying to figure out how much of an impact this would have on the NBA is that, you know, soccer has resumed in Europe recently. And Florida had more had thousands more cases over the weekend than Spain, England, Germany, and Italy combined. That is just a mind-blowing statistic to me, and one that really makes it feel like hey, all the precautions that have been taken in other sports around the world that are ostensibly being able to pull this thing off with success, they did not have to deal with locating their games in Florida in a hotbed. You know, I think that, you know, can you imagine if COVID is rampant right outside the bubble and, you know, the hospitals are overwhelmed and it's a daily news story and, you know, the tests that are being used by the NBA every day to make sure that the players don't have not come down with coronavirus and that everyone in the bubble is safe. Like, as they use those tests, are tests going to be needed outside of the bubble and in other places in the state? So I just think that it's not great. And obviously, the bubble is not even a foolproof safeguard. And all those pages and those rules that the NBA released, like none of that is 100% foolproof. So if you throw everybody into this situation and in this really dangerous environment, like I just don't think that it's a smart move. And I'm increasingly pessimistic about it working because of the rise in cases that we're seeing right now.
Well, Michael, I'm going to go stat for stat with you, okay? We're going to be breaking down COVID like it's a greatest of all time debate here. the issue going on right now in Florida, it's not just a matter of more tests being taken so that there's more positive results. There's actually a higher positivity rate in Florida as well. So what that means is basically like a greater percentage of the population that's being tested today is testing positive as compared to a couple weeks ago. So that means it's spreading. It's pretty much undeniable. It's not just a matter of, oh, hey, the government's on it, and so now we're discovering all these cases. You know, it's a situation right. That's worsening. I think it's also important to point out that over the weekend, the numbers in terms of new cases, it was about a five-fold increase from when the NBA first said it wanted to go to Disney World back in May. So the dynamics have changed significantly rapidly, right? Like when the NBA was first looking at Disney World, whether or not you wanted to believe Florida's numbers, and there's been some question about whether those numbers were legitimate early in the process, you know, Florida's governor Ron DeSantis was publicly campaigning basically for sports leagues to come play there. And at that time, Florida had it way better than a hot spot like New York City. I mean, there's just no question about it. It was apples to oranges. But now Florida's new case rate has accelerated basically by five times in less than a month, and is now getting to the point where it's almost half of what the peak levels were in New York City, you know, during the very worst of the outbreak. Now, is Florida or any other state ever going to reach that same level that New York City did? Probably not, because that's a very dense city. Everybody was unprepared. There wasn't any social distancing going on. You know, stores and parties were open at 100% capacity back then, as opposed to being limited capacity right now in Florida. But still, it's an eye-opening number. And your point on the conditions directly outside of the bubble are very important, because as we've described, this is not a fixed bubble. People can come in and people can come out, whether it's the housekeeping staff, whether it's the media members in some cases who are going to be able to stay outside of the bubble and report on games, you know, at the facilities. There are protections to keep players away from direct contact with anyone who's going to be going outside of the bubble. But as we know, if it's not a strict lockdown, you know, there's going to be some risk involved there. And add on to the fact that the players, you know, will not be, you know, expelled, and they're not prevented from leaving the bubble. So, you know, any player who does decide to stray outside for a night on the town or to blow off some steam or whatever else could be at a much higher risk than they would have expected even 1 month ago during the same situation. So you're seeing a player like Justice Winslow and others, you know, raise these concerns as just real life impacts that are, you know, factoring into their decision making. I don't blame them at all. I mean, it's pretty scary stuff. I know for myself, like trying to plan, you know, if I'm going down there to cover it, how am I going to get there? You're seeing some tests, you know, positive tests at the Orlando airport. You know, you're wondering, you know, what about like an Uber to Disney World? I mean, all these kinds of questions look a lot different today than they did even, you know, 3 weeks ago. And so it's definitely something for all fans, basketball fans, to be monitoring here. It's not like you've got to reload the Google coronavirus stats every single day, but keep your eye on it, because it's kind of becoming a whack-a-mole situation for Adam Silver, isn't it? It's like one moment it's coronavirus, the next moment it's players who are really upset and justifiably so about the social justice protests and whether it's going to be a distraction. The next minute, Florida's on fire. I mean, it's just one thing after another after another.
Yeah, it's all of these signs that they shouldn't play. But Ben, think about when Rudy Gobert tested positive and how the league swiftly acted to just suspend the season right then. Like, what makes I like, obviously there wasn't a bubble environment set up, that there wasn't any real precaution. It was kind of taking everybody by storm. But like, when you look at what the setting was for that decision, and then you look at however many months later to where we are now, and like, what more do we know about coronavirus and COVID that is so substantial, minus a vaccine, that makes it logical to then resume action in a hotbed? Like, it's just looking at it from that perspective, it's kind of wild to me.
I would say that we do know a little bit more about the mortality rate. We do know a little bit more about who is impacted the worst. I do think that some of the initial fear and panic, which we could argue is justifiable fear and panic back in March, has subsided to a degree. Now, that's not that we learned anything. It's just that we became comfortable living in a world that had this disease. But your points are very well taken. I mean, I wouldn't say we're exactly where we were in March, but in terms of how right. serious this this health situation is, how incredibly difficult it will be to make it through not even just the 3 months of basketball in Orlando, but even just the 2 to 3 weeks of run-up to getting to Orlando, which teams are going to start going through this week as players report and as they start to go through coronavirus testing and everything else. I mean, even that is going to be a series of hurdles that they've got to jump through. And there could certainly be positive tests here coming out here over the next week or two, as guys start to show up with their home teams. Because remember, as they start to gather in their home markets, they're not required to live in a bubble. They can be living at home with family members. They can go to protest. The players were able to get that language into this agreement. So if they want to go and participate in social justice protests or go to the grocery store or participate in other essential activities, which are all going to carry some level of risk, they're going to be able to do that until they get down to Orlando. So all of that is the possibility for positive tests and potential spread as well. All right, we're getting a little bit too dark here, Michael. Let's switch this up with a question from Ross in Australia. He writes, "Our Australian Football League started back up last weekend, and it was okay. Honestly, it was a little bit dull with cardboard cutout crowds and such, but it was good to watch the AFL again. This weekend, we were a quarter way through the games for round three, and we had one of the players that hadn't played this round test positive for the virus. The league postponed that game for the following day and had set this contingency by only releasing games for a four-week block. They haven't advised their plan for replaying that game or what happens if there are multiple breakouts on the same team. The difference between the AFL and the NBA is that we were almost at playoffs while the AFL has just barely started. What chance is there the NBA continues the playoffs if there are multiple outbreaks in the same team? Is it simply too bad for that team? And then what happens to the team that they were playing against?" So this is a very important point that Ross is mentioning. And we talked about the downsides of inviting 22 teams to Florida, Michael, in terms of the complications and everything else. But that also left them with a pretty rigid schedule. They don't have a lot of wiggle room to delay a series by a week or two if they want to keep this thing on track in any, you know, meaningful manner if there is a positive test, right? So the show kind of has to go on. I think they're going to have to leave behind any players that test positive. It's just sort of a tough luck situation. I don't know how they would be able to do kind of the start and stop thing that Ross is describing unless there was a massive outbreak that affected basically all of the contenders. We should also point out we're seeing start and stop stuff happen in Florida right now. The Philadelphia Phillies of Major League Baseball had to shut down their spring training facility after multiple players tested positive. Same thing for the Tampa Bay Lightning of the NHL. They had to shut down their facility. We saw both the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the University of South Florida football team both had multiple tests for their players. They have continued with practices so far, but those players have had to be isolated. So, you know, again, it goes back to this idea of the situation on the ground in Florida. If it's spread to that degree where multiple professional teams have had to shut down at least temporarily and others are kind of, you know, on the block potentially for being next, it only increases, to me, at least the appearance of complications for the NBA.
Yeah, and I think a really good point that I recently heard made by ESPN's Kevin Arnovitz is that, let's say a team does have a mini outbreak or whatever, and like three guys test positive or four players test positive, I think there could be the potential for a significant fear factor that spreads to players who are on teams where no one has tested positive, where it's like, I don't want to, like, I know that it's here. I don't want to play and risk getting it because I still don't know what the long-term effects of this thing are to my lungs. I still don't know. I still don't want to get it and then spread it to a loved one asymptomatically. So I think that that factor could, you know, we talk a lot about who tests positive and then they would have to quarantine and they wouldn't be able to play. But I think it could spread in unforeseeable ways to other players, you know, not technically as the virus, but just the fear of catching it, knowing that it has broken the bubble and that it is inside the facility. So I think that that is a really scary and unpredictable and unforeseeable scenario that I just don't know how the league kind of deals with.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I think that, you know, for now, their strategy is cross your fingers and hope for the best and take some really serious precautions to slow everything down. And, you know, if the worst case scenario comes, I imagine there will be a plug pulling moment. You know, other executives have had to make that difficult call. I think that, you know, the risk reward of trying to go forward with this, I mean, the reward is potentially $2 billion for the league, right? And, you know, in terms of revenue. So that allows you, I would imagine, you know, from a very cynical perspective, the ability to take on quite a bit of risk before you're willing to compromise that again, in part because you've spent all this time, money, and energy negotiating deals and putting together this return. But at some point, you know, it would become bad for business, I would imagine. And, you know, at that point, I don't think Adam Silver would have a choice. You know, well, where exactly that line is, I don't know.
And I have a question. I mean, I know that the rosters have been expanded to 17 players, but how accommodating do you think the league will be in terms of shuttling in replacement players, like G League guys, guys who, like, let's say a team has 8 positive tests or whatever, and that those players are quarantining, but it's in the middle of a playoff series. And like you said, there's a time crunch. Like, we can't wait forever because next season is pending and the Olympics are next summer, and there's just a lot of things that have to get done as quickly as possible. So if, like, will the league just bring in other players? And then if they were to do that, like, what would that do to the product? And why would anyone want to watch, no offense, I don't mean to be disrespectful to players who are in the G League by any means, but why would a casual fan want to watch a unknown player who they are unfamiliar with compete at this level? Like, I just, maybe what I'm saying is, like, too speculative and not something that the league would actually do, but I don't know how else you would play games if you needed players to get it done.
Personally, I think if that situation came about, there would be not enough time to get players into the bubble safely, right? And so there would probably have to be a forfeit, you know? And that would be an absolute last resort before shutting down the entire thing. But if I had to make that call and a team got, you know, 8 positive tests, I think I would have to call their president and be like, hey guys, you know, you can play with your 7, or let's say they even had 12 positive tests, right? So they couldn't, they couldn't field a team. I think I would have to call the president and say, hey man, of that team, and just say, tough luck. We knew there was going to be a risk involved. We gave it our best effort. You know, we don't really have the ability to give you safe replacement players. And so we have to call this a forfeit. If you want to play 3-on-5, I guess I would give them that opportunity, right? it turns into a, you know, a last man standing kind of Lord of the Flies type situation. No, I think, you know, if it came to that, I imagine they would allow a forfeit to take place before canceling this whole thing. As crazy and crude as this sounds, I think that would be the move. That's what I would do.
Do you think that they would go? I actually don't think that this would ever happen for a lot of reasons, but, like, let's say it's the second round of the playoffs and there were players who were, let's say someone on the Spurs who didn't make it out of the, after the 8 games, did not qualify for the playoffs, but some players on the Spurs decided to stick around for whatever reason. Like,
what you're basically saying is, like, if Markieff Morris gets sick, can they sub in Marcus Morris and just keep going? No, I don't think you could do that, Michael. I mean,
no, probably. No, well, that particular example, sure you can. No one's going to call you on it. But, like, no, yeah.
I think that, like, first of all, any player who gets eliminated from this thing is going home on the very first charter flight. Like,
that is correct.
Smoking. They may be driving rental cars out of that thing at full speed. You know, I think there is no chance that anyone's going to be sitting around, and that's part of the problem. I mean, that's the thing. You have to have hundreds and hundreds of players to put this thing on, and you have contracts for each of those players tied to other organizations, so you can't exactly loan players out or do what they do in soccer, you know, where there's sort of, different ways to transfer players rather than just simple, straightforward trades or signings. Because if that player were to get hurt, you know, then the owner in that organization, his original team, would be compromised. That's why I think they would be stuck. I don't think there would be enough time or ability to kind of put in, like, an emergency signing window. I think that it would just, you know, unfortunately wind up being a forfeit type situation. Let's hope it doesn't come to that. I thought I was trying to get us away from the darkness, Michael. All right, here's a question from John. He says, I heard Michael's concerns on the last podcast that players should be discouraged from helping each other up off the ground after falling just to reduce the level of contact between players. Why don't we just take this further? Players are often on the ground after getting fouled. Maybe all players should be asked, please don't commit fouls. Any defensive contact could become a foul now. We could change the rules. Defensive spacing could require coming no closer than 2 feet away from any offensive player. Or maybe everyone could foul out after 3 fouls to cut down on the contact. And then John continues, okay, guys, sarcasm over. But my point is, If they're going to play, they are going to play. We'll see how it works out, and I certainly hope that the health prevails. But once you've made the decision, there really isn't any point to trying to manage on-court safety to that kind of a level. I still love you, Michael. Stay skeptical. So, Michael, that was a very nice love note from John, and including some healthy sarcasm. Do you hear his point, though? I guess what he's saying is, like, we might be overanalyzing the NBA's health and safety protocol here slightly, and that when it comes to the actual games, we need to just step back and expect them to be normal games.
No, maybe I misrepresented myself when I said that point on the last episode. What I meant more was just like how weird it would be for the players from their perspective to, like, are they going to be second guessing themselves in terms of, should I help this dude up instead of, like, should I sprint over and help this guy up as opposed to, when 6 months ago when I was playing basketball, I wouldn't think twice. I would run over and I would help this dude up. And obviously that's like a minor thing, but it's more like just from the, not like an official rule, just the players, their comfort level and what they're thinking about during the course of games in a stadium when there's no fans and they're constantly reminded of the global pandemic with guys on the bench who have masks on and that sort of thing. So it's just, that's more what I was going for with that point.
No, you made your point very well, I thought. I mean, some of this stuff is just learned behavior and you've been doing it your entire life. It's not just about, oh, you know, what's our team handshake and all that. It's like all these habits that I've built up over 20 years of playing basketball are very hard to unlearn. I mean, take LeBron James. I mean, he kind of compulsively wipes his hands off on his jersey or the shirt underneath his jersey constantly when he's bringing the ball up to court, right? I think behavior like that, you know, according to the NBA's health and safety protocol, you're trying to minimize that. Well, good luck telling LeBron that. You know, Brandon Roy used to do the same thing, constantly wiping his hands off, during Blazers games. Probably did it 150 times or different free throw routines that guys have where, it's so deeply ingrained to them. Like, you could tell them and point at the health protocol all day long, and it's going to be very difficult to change that. So I'm mostly with John here. I think they're going to try to keep the gameplay as normal as possible. But I just think the overall point that we were trying to make, John, is that not only will it be an adjustment for players to some of the rules and the guidance that they're already being given, but the viewing experience will be different because even the way they're laying the benches out are completely different than what we've seen, you know, during a normal NBA game. The fact that a lot of the personnel is there is going to be wearing masks and gloves, that's very different from what we're accustomed to. So, this is not going to be typical NBA basketball. And, I think that there will be an adjustment period if we ever get to watch these games, Michael, where everyone's like trying to wrap their minds around all the things that are different. All right, one final COVID question. It comes in from Tom. He says, "Hey guys, I'm a relatively new listener. I found you guys through Ben's appearances on Locked On NBA. I live in Central Texas, though I hail from the Portland area." Well, Tom, shout out to Portland and to David Locke and the Locked On family. Love doing those shows. You guys can catch me there almost every Thursday. All right, his question. With several COVID vaccines entering late stage clinical trials, would it be wise for the NBA to push for enrolling players and coaching staffs in these trials in the hopes of immunity by the time next season begins? If the league encouraged this approach, do you think it would be met favorably? In a similar vein, what do you think the reaction would be to the NBA requiring fans who attend games this fall to provide evidence of either a positive antibody test or vaccination to enter arenas? So first thing, Tom, the NBA is asking players to participate, I think, in like an antibody study of some sort through Yale University, or maybe it's a saliva test study through Yale University that has been placed into the health and safety protocol. So they're on the same track, I guess, generally as you are, Tom, in terms of trying to make sure the players are participating and kind of furthering along the medical efforts, you know, within the study of COVID. But Michael, what do you think about Tom's question here on vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a scientist, so this one's a tricky one for me to answer.
Well, that's never stopped a lot of people in our country before, frankly. I mean, especially these days. Aren't we all scientists, Michael?
I pride myself on knowing when to stay in my lane, Ben. I think that, you know, the antibody test I'll start there. It's just like it's far from the silver bullet right now. And, you know, if you were asymptomatic, you can test negative for it after a few months, even if you had coronavirus. And it also, I believe, still only has a 50% accuracy rate. So I don't even know, like, what the latest is on all this, on all the science and what everybody knows about it. I know that what you just said about the league pushing players, I also wonder, like, is that an MBPA situation where maybe players don't want to participate? I don't even know what is the protocol here or how confusing it is. But in terms of, like, the vaccine actually happening and how that'll impact fans from entering arenas and that sort of thing also, I just think it'll be a while before any of this is actually relevant, when we got to actually wonder if stadiums can be full and to what percentage and capacity. And so, yeah, again, I'm rambling, but I'm not a scientist, so I'm doing my best here, Ben.
No, you're doing great. I would say that I don't think NBA players are going to be thrown into vaccine trials. I'll put it that way. I think that there would be pushback, as you're mentioning, not only from the players' union, but also from their agents. I wouldn't say that these guys are skeptical of science. I think a lot of players embrace testing, scientific approach to weight management, conditioning programs, all sorts of stuff. But when it's an unknown that has, potentially major, long-term health implications, I just think there's always going to be a natural wariness. Now, if it's proven that it works in trials, I bet NBA players will be at the front of the line to get them just because they've got the resources to do it. And, again, that's sort of the way the world works, as I believe our president once said, of access to testing in the first place. So I guess I'm coming down on that side where they probably won't be part of the trials, but they will be there as soon as possible to get the vaccine itself, if and when it happens. And by the way, Michael, I will be elbowing people out of line in the vaccine line to inject myself from every direction if we can ever get that thing. God, it just seems like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, doesn't it? So what about on the second question about the fans? Like, could you see some scenario where potentially if fans have a vaccine, then that'll, puts them to the front of the season ticket holder line, Michael, where, like, next year we can kind of maybe open up buildings earlier than we're anticipating because the vaccine will be widespread enough that it will be safe for people to kind of accumulate in large crowds?
Yeah, I mean, I think if there is a vaccine that is permeating through our culture that is widely available, then people will have a lot more confidence in attending games. And I think as a liability issue, I think stadiums will be more likely to, or be more comfortable letting people in to full capacity as opposed to like 50% or 75% or whatever. And I think states also would be fine letting people in as well. So I think the vaccine is more the silver bullet than the antibody test is my, long, short answer to this question.
No, that makes sense. I'm with you. I mean, I could think that that's the only way we're going to see fans in the stadiums next year is if there is a widespread vaccine available. There is some method for kind of confirming whether people have it. I don't know exactly how you would have to go about that interfacing with the teams. But to me, it makes a lot of sense. I like the idea from the emailer. And I'm sure that, there's nothing that the NBA owners want more than butts in the seats, because that's such a huge portion of their revenue that, and to get there, you have to get over the mental hurdles that people are going to have about being in public spaces. As we saw over the weekend, something like 6,000 people were willing to go to a presidential rally that was advertised all over the country for 2 weeks, right? And that to me displays a real level of fear and apprehension of that virus, right? I mean, there's other possible explanations, but that's the most obvious, kind of top line one. And, to see people, crowd into an arena for a Kings game or a Jazz game or, pick a team, There's going to need to be a peace of mind, and certainly the vaccine could provide that in ways that really nothing else could. So, you know, if we're going to see a full stadium, that's what it's going to take. Great point by the emailer. All right, last one here from our longtime buddy Stavros in Sydney. He writes, I've always taken umbrage with the much-trodden trope that the Stars win championships or that the team with the best player always wins the series. I'm not sure if the quote-unquote Stars are the chicken or the egg in this theory, but whichever one it is, it's the one that came second. Stars truly become Stars because they win championships. So championships come first, then players are labeled as the best player in the series they just won, thus fulfilling a self-fulfilling prophecy that the Stars win championships. Please discuss and dispel this mythology and answer once and for all, which came first, the championship or the Star? So, Michael, do you get what Stavros is getting at here, that when people say, oh, that the team that had the best player won the series, that that's often reliant on the team actually winning the series, and that if it had gone the other way, we would just say the same thing about the best player on the winning team? Are you with him on that?
This is the most galaxy brain question that I think we've ever received as podcast hosts. I thoroughly enjoyed it, though. I'm not putting it down.
Michael, this is Stavros's baseline, okay? He's operating on a different plane. I mean, he is a four-dimensional chess type of thinker, has been for years. He only brings you the heaters. I ask you the tough questions. Stavros asks you the incomprehensibly tough questions, okay?
This was like if I'm in the batter's box, this fastball is 129 miles an hour. I don't think it's that complicated. Like, if you're a Star, you're a Star because you win. And I think that those two components kind of go hand in hand, and it's very just straightforward to me. Am I even answering this question? I don't even know, but...
Let me jump in real quick, because sure. I think that the idea that the team with the best player always wins the series has actually been proven false repeatedly in recent years, thanks to LeBron and the Cavaliers. Like, the Cavaliers,
oh, sure. Yeah.
Didn't they almost construct their team precisely to prove this false? It's like, let's see how many J.R. Smith blunders we can force LeBron to trip through as he's dominating the sport and still coming up short and finishing second. So, Stavros, I reject the premise off the top. That's number one. I do. What really bothers me, though, is how much we tie Finals MVP to being, you know, kind of the quote-unquote best player on the winning team or the most important player on the winning team. I would like to see the Finals MVP given out more often to just the pure best player in the series, regardless of winning or losing. There's been a couple times where I would have personally voted for LeBron to have that designation. It doesn't happen that often. But I do think that you get into certain situations that, you know, where this line of thinking comes from, where just, you know, it does prove true. Like, just flat out, the guy who played the best, you know, Jordan would be the most obvious example in the 90s, where there was just no question who the best player was. And of course, his team won those series. But, you know, you can go back in earlier, you know, matchups against the Pistons, and you can make a strong case that, much like, you know, current LeBron, Jordan was the best player on the court, but he was still coming up short. I also think that, Stavros, it might be misdefining Stars here a little bit. You know, that Stars win championships. There's plenty of Stars that don't win championships. Everybody would agree Charles Barkley, John Stockton, Karl Malone were star level players, even superstar level players. I think that we've now gotten ourselves into this super team era where the treatment's a little bit different. It's almost like the best combination of talent or the most super team, you know, super teams win championships has kind of become the new mantra. Who's ever can, you know, compile the most star power collectively is the team that is, you know, kind of quote unquote guaranteed to win the title. But even then, you know, we've got the Mavericks upending that conversation in 2011. We've got the Spurs upending that conversation in 2014. We've got the Raptors, you know, and the injuries played a factor there, but upending the conversation in 2019 as well. So, Stavros, I say forget about the chicken and the egg. Find new maxims. These maxims do not apply. Throw them in the trash can.
I agree with everything you said, Ben. I will throw in, like, I just don't think that winning the title even necessarily should demand that you are a superstar. Or I guess the other way around is what I'm trying to say. Like, I'm just thinking about someone like James Harden, who's just so clearly a superstar, regardless of whether or not he wins a championship. And I've always thought that the people who were critical of someone who is so clearly good enough to win it all, but just didn't have the breaks necessarily fall in their favor. I just never understood that type of criticism. And he's an example. And another kind of weird example is like the argument that Kevin Durant outplayed LeBron in those finals when he was with the Warriors versus the Cavs. And it was kind of just like, no, like you could look at it statistically and say, sure, Kevin Durant had better numbers or whatever. But like the supporting casts and just adding that context in, it just kind of killed it for me. Like, obviously, LeBron was still a better player. LeBron didn't have Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. And now we're going down a rabbit hole here. But like that has always bothered me because it was just so clear to me that LeBron was the best player in those series.
No, and that's when I always go to the thing of, like, if they traded spots, right? If you just traded the two players, what would the series wind up looking like? And that's why I've always felt like a lot of those series, LeBron was the best player on the court because, you know, Kevin, if he was on the weaker team, would have struggled to achieve the same result, whether it's how long the series went or what the numbers look like compared to what LeBron did. I mean, as the counterpoint, the opposite point of what you're trying to say with Harden being a star, just never having won, I think we've also seen guys who were stars before they won. Kevin Durant is a great example. Steph Curry is another great example. Now, do they get validated to a different degree historically because they have the rings? I think so. Do they move up the charts of the all-time players because of that? For sure. But I don't think that people were snubbing their nose at those players and saying, oh, come on, you know, these guys are bums until they finally got it done. I think that would be overly simplistic. So Stavros, we're going to workshop on some more accurate, applicable maxims that we can use, but we've poked holes in all the ones that you sent our way. I think that's actually going to make you happy because it sounds to me like you don't really buy them too much either. But feel free to roast anyone who uses those blanket statements because they simply do not apply every single year. All right, Michael, we've reached the end of another episode of Open Floor. Guys, you can always email us your responses to anything we talked about today. openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. You can email us about anything else too, frankly. We're always glad to take a look at your thoughts here as the NBA tries to get itself back on track. Michael, we're on Apple Podcasts. Listeners can search for us by typing in Open Floor. Once they find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. The last time I checked, Michael, I think we're over 2,000 reviews on there. I would love it if somebody's listening right now, stops what they're doing, and bumps us up one more. It would be amazing. It really helps us out. Michael is on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golver, on Twitter at Ben Golver. And Michael, we'll double back later this week. But until then, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.